Welcome to Screenplay, the podcast companion to the new masterful 19-track interpretation of songs specifically written for the big screen, as performed by the 8-time Grammy-nominated Tierney Sutton Band, the culmination of their 20-plus year collaboration. Hi, I'm Doug McIntyre, your lucky host. And collaboration is the word of the day. The Tierney Sutton Band, comprised of Christian Jacob on piano, Trey Henry and Kevin X on bass, Ray Brinker on drums and percussion, along with, of course, Ms. Sutton's vocals, create all their arrangements collaboratively. And for that reason, Act One of Screenplay celebrates one of the all-time great collaborative lyricist teams, Alan and Marilyn Bergman, with 16 Academy Award nominations and 3 Oscar wins. One year, 3 of the 5 nominated best songs were written by Alan and Marilyn Bergman. They didn't win. You never win when you're nominated in 3 of 5 categories. Ladies and gentlemen, the Bergmans have collaborated with musical masters Michel Legrand, Dave Grusin, Lou Spence, Johnny Mandel, Cy Coleman, Quincy Jones, Marvin Hamlisch, Henry Mancini, and John Williams. And now, with the Tierney Sutton Band, let's fade in on Act One of Screenplay with Alan Bergman. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. And Tierney Sutton, welcome aboard.
Hi there.
And tell us about Screenplay.
Well, Screenplay is an interesting thing. It's the first time we've done a project like this. We are indeed going to release an album, Screenplay, a 15-track album. But we decided that there was so much music and it couldn't all fit on one album. So we decided to organize it in chapters or acts. And so we, in addition to releasing a 15-song album in the normal CD sense, we're also going to release 5 acts, each of those organized around a theme or era of music. And the first act is the Bergman Suite. All 5 of those songs will be on the final LP CD Screenplay. But in all the other acts, there'll be bonus tracks that won't be in the completed project that you can only get digitally. So each of these acts will be things that people can download digitally, and then when the CD is released, they'll be able to get the physical CD as well.
Now, Screenplay is going to feature music from the Golden Age, which will be the 30s and 40s and 50s, into the then, of course, music from the 1960s, and going forward to today's era, of course. Why did you choose to start Screenplay with the Bergman Suite?
That was a really easy decision for the band. At one point, actually, we thought about just doing an all Bergman project. But we just decided that it might be fun to expand things to film. And Alan and Marilyn basically are the core of American film music as far as we're concerned. So starting with the 5 Bergman tracks really felt really important to us. In addition to the fact that we're all very close to Alan and Marilyn and we've been collaborating with them in different ways for 20 years.
We'll come back to that collaboration in a bit, but I want to ask Alan, could you talk to us about the difference, or if there is a difference, when you write a song specifically for a film where you know it's going to be supporting a visual element versus a song that might be a shelf song for a vocalist to get his or her lucky hands on?
A shelf song, I don't know what that means.
Well, in other words, for instance, a song like Where Do You Start that wasn't written specifically for a project.
Okay.
Versus a song that's on a commission that you know is going to be part of a film?
Well, you know, when you write a song for a film, and I don't mean the ones that are the end titles. I mean, when they're part of an extension of the screenplay, so to speak, you have a lot of things to work with. You have the scene, you have the character, the story, and the image that you're working with, plus a great composer. And all these elements, there's a big difference. When you get a melody like Where Do You Start, for instance, you just have the melody. But Marilyn and I feel that when you get melodies like that, and you and they're wonderful, they have words on the tips of those notes, and we have to find them. You know, those melodies sing. So the writing is entirely different.
How early in the process do they give you the actual screenplay so that you can read it and see the story? Or does the director or the creative force literally say, we want something here?
Well, in some cases, it depends. One of the songs we wrote, the What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, for instance, the director and writer, a man by the name of Richard Brooks, wonderful, he said he wouldn't send it, he wouldn't let part of the screenplay out of his office. He sent it, we kept asking, when he sent us the script once, and it had our names on it and everything, we opened it up and it was filled with blank pages. Nothing but blank pages. And he showed us the movie in a rough cut. Mm-hmm. But he said when he was writing the film that he was writing a place for two songs, a song to appear twice in the movie. Different, you know, I didn't mean different song, same song. Mm-hmm. And in this case, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life? The first time you hear it, it was behind a love montage. These two people were very much in love in college, and they were going to get married, and they did get married. So the first time you hear it, it's a real love song. Second time you hear it, he said it's 16 years later. They've been married. They have a child. But he's a workaholic, and she became an alcoholic. And he said she leaves her home and her child and her husband, never to go back again, goes to her favorite bar, lines up the martinis, puts a dime in the jukebox, and he said, now we hear the same song, but it has to be ironic. Mm-hmm. So when you see this woman, you drunk, you know, puts the nickel in and you hear, what are you doing the rest of your life? Mm-hmm. It means something entirely different.
Yeah, well, that's it shows you how the reading of a song by the singer can also take different colors.
Except in this particular case, that's true, but in this case, it had to be the same record.
Record, right. Mm-hmm. And just the context of it gave it a different meaning.
Exactly.
Now, screenplays obviously tell a story.
Hopefully,
right. There have been plenty that haven't, and I've written a few of them, actually. But songs can tell a story, too.
Oh, yeah.
And there are songs that can be classified as a story song. One that comes to mind immediately would be something like Guess Who I Saw Today, mm-hmm. That has a sort of a kicker at the end of it. But when you and Marilyn sit down to write a lyric to a melody, do you look for the story first, or do you look for a lyrical hook?
Well, I don't know what you mean by lyrical, but what's important about any song is the idea. Now, if you get the idea, and hopefully it's a good one, you know, your craft takes you a little bit along the way. But we, unlike, for instance, Irving Berlin, who knew, he knew where he was going, when he started a song, he knew where it was going at the end. Hmm. We have no idea. Hmm. You know, for instance, you know, I Got Lost in His Arms, Irving Berlin's song, wonderful song. He knew that I got lost in his arms. He knew that at the last part, the last few bars, it would say, but look what I found. Hmm. He knew that. I mean, and that's where he worked to. We don't know where we're going.
Do you think that he was aided because he was writing his own music, that helped
that
him
too.
Shape
Well, that's
his storytelling.
Yeah, yeah. But the method of knowing, you know, in front where you go.
But I think that there are some examples where you've done that. I'm trying to think. But I think in subtle ways, you and Marilyn have done that a few times.
I've
been in the room here with you where you've said things like, I think maybe we could go here, and then it's a matter of setting it up. I've heard you say that.
Yeah.
So I think that you have an element of that in your writing. You've got more in your bag of tricks than you're letting on. Yeah.
Let me stick to the theme of storytelling, though, from screenplay to the project, the musical project before us. Because you're telling a story too, Tierney, and your band is telling a story in this five-act suite. Mm-hmm. What story is it that you're trying to tell?
Well, I think in terms of Alan and Marilyn's work, each of these songs was really precious to me. And some of them had been recorded more than once, let's just say. And I think that the band in general likes to take something that you think you've heard and uncover something new in it. And one example of that, I think, in the project is the opening track, which is The Windmills of Your Mind. And that arrangement is mostly mine, but of course the band collaborates in fleshing all of this stuff out. And I was trying to search for a meter that would show the sort of circular nature. I experimented literally for about 3 years with that song, 3 or 4 years, maybe more, because I started to do an arrangement for Hubert Laws and me and Larry Kuntz in our little group that we did together. And I thought, well, should I do it as a waltz, which is kind of round, you know, and I settled on a 15/8 time signature, because I wanted to have forward motion in part of it. And so, and first I got it okayed by Alan. I said, well, I don't want to do this and have it be something that will sound forced in any way. It has to serve the story. So let's see if I can do it. And so the rhythm of it, round, like, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever-spinning reel, like a snowball down a mountain or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon. You see how it kind of, there's one little bit of three where it's been four, 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 and then there's three. You see, and it gives a sort of forward motion, and each of the places where it is the bar of three, there's an image of circularness.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reference to the moon or a circle. And then on the bridge, we go to seven, so there are twice as many portions of three that make it go forward faster. And so the whole idea of the anxiety of the song, and of course, the whole idea of the story of the song for me was learned by hearing Alan sing it and having the pleasure of having that experience. I thought, okay, I understand this song now. I never had understood it before.
This song, of course, is from the Thomas Crown Affair in 1968 and ended up winning the Academy Award. By the way, beat out Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
and also there was a new song written by Julie Stein and Bob Hilliard.
Russell?
Bob, no.
No.
Anyway, I'll remember his name in a minute. And they wrote a new song for Funny Girl that came out the same year. We never thought we were going to win. But to getting back to when you're asking about context, you know, in the case of Windmills, the director, a wonderful director, Norman Jewison, who knows, you know, how to use a song and so on. He showed us the film and the flight of the glider. And the Steve McQueen character flying this glider. He had just masterminded the robbery of a bank. And he was very nervous and anxious because he didn't know what to do with the money. He was just a board playboy who And so Norman said, I want you to write a song that underlines the anxiety that the character was feeling. And he, as I said, he showed us the clip. Now, the anxiety is a circular emotion. You know, it's like before you go to sleep, you can't turn your mind off. And then the flight of the glider is circular.
Yes.
So all the images in that song are circular images, round like a circle and a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on a spinning wheel. They're all circular. And that's, speaking of writing in context, and then Michelle wrote, before we wrote a word, he wrote four or five different melodies. And
wow. How do you choose?
Yeah, well, we said, how do we choose? And the next day, the three of us, Alan, Michelle, and I, picked the same melody to work with. That's... Of course, it was a Baroque kind of circular thing that the melody had.
But the thing is, Alan, I think a lot of people think of that as just a song with a bunch of circular images. And it's more than that, because the climax of the song is that in your sort of fevered circular thinking, you eventually get to when you knew that it was over, in the autumn of goodbyes, for a moment you could not recall the color of his eyes. That's the woman singing lyric, and then the male one is the autumn leaves were turning to the color of his hair. So you're going through and going through, and then you finally get to the climax, which is the loss of the relationship. So you're in all of this circular thinking, but the underlying worry is something much more profound than just thinking about circular things.
The song, of course, The Windmills of Your Mind, with a melody by Michel Legrand, I think is one of the most interesting songs, because it doesn't easily fit into a category. It's not a list song. Mm-hmm. It's not really a story song. It literally is inside. It's a thought song. It's inside someone's head. In fact, the song that I parrot to in my non-musical brain is Jobim's "The Waters of March."
Uh-huh.
Which I almost feel like it was inspired. Later. Came after, right?
I think of them together too. In a strange way.
Because they're not linear in any way, shape, or form. They are circular. Tierney, there's one line, and I always kind of was curious about this from a vocalist perspective, whether this helps shape the arrangement. Because this song on Screenplay in the Bergman Suite starts with this wonderful ticking percussive beat by Ray Brinker. And there's a line in the song, of course, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like that shapes the arrangement.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, we came up with the basic structure of it, and it was obvious that the first thing that should happen is that ticking sound that Ray came up with, and we said, this is great, and it should end that way too. And that was with consultation from Alan too, as we were playing different versions of it. He said, yeah, it should end with that too. And I said, you're right on the money. So, and then we decided, Trey and I had worked with Alan several times. Alan and I have been doing shows together for the last several years, and he always opens singing that song. And Trey said, we really should start with it rubato somehow. And so the ticking is going on, but I'm phrasing the beginning of the song like Alan does on his gorgeous CD, lyrically, rubato. Trying to draw people in and then going into the time signature.
It's a really unique piece of music, and a marriage of words to a unique piece of music that in this particular interpretation is one of the best I've ever heard. And it is, I have to go back to how this came to the public. Noel Harrison sang it in the film.
Yes.
But Andy Williams passed on it. What was Andy Williams thinking?
I don't know.
Poor bastard.
Because I noticed he didn't miss singing any of your other songs.
Yeah,
but we were forever grateful to Norman, because, Andy had sung
Yeah, he did a lot of themes. Yeah, it was him and Matt Monroe were doing all of the movie titles. Yeah.
And Norman said, you know, Andy said, I love the music, but if Marilyn Allen would rewrite the lyric, and Norman said, I wouldn't have them change a syllable. You know.
Wow.
A less strong director would have said, well, we've got a hit writer.
Right, a big star singer, right.
Well, but Alan, didn't you tell me that was the first song you wrote with Michelle?
Yeah, that's the first song we wrote.
Which is amazing. I mean, to me, once Michelle realized you could do that with that melody, he had to say, sign me up. I mean, he had to feel that way. I don't know any other lyricist or lyricist team that could have come up with that.
Well, the lyric, which seems like genius. It's a bunch of disassociated thoughts, but that is a mind in anxiety. That's a mind that's running in circles like a hamster wheel. We've all experienced at night when you can't get to sleep because you're worried about something. I want to ask you, Alan, about Noel Harrison. I heard what I think is an entertaining sort of inside recording battle between vocalist and composers, in that he was fighting you over the pronunciation of the word shore.
No, shine.
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 That's because in
British,
in England, it's shun.
Where the sun has never shunned, not shone.
Yeah, and we kept, said that. That's my language. We said, but that's our lyric.
And that's your rhyme.
And that's,
through a tunnel to a cavern of its own where the sun has never shone.
Yeah.
You miss the rhyme if you say shun.
Yeah.
So you won that fight anyway.
Oh, yeah, we won that fight, but, the...
Then Sting
brought
it back.
And Sting did the same thing, made the same error.
Yeah.
In the Thomas Crown
Affair
remake of 99.
Why he doesn't hear it, I mean, he's a songwriter, but...
It's a very long lyric.
Long?
Yeah, there's a lot of words.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of words. A lot of notes.
That's
you get
right.
All those notes, you have to, we didn't change a dot, not a dot.
That's amazing.
When he gave us the melody.
We are talking with Tierney Sutton, whose 19-track... five-act celebration of movie music is called Screenplay. And we're also talking with the great lyricist Alan Bergman, who together with his wife Marilyn has written some of the most memorable songs in the entire vocabulary of songs. I want to move along to one from that very creative period of 1968-1969 from a film called The Happy Ending. Another song you wrote with Michel Legrand, and this one we touched on earlier, it's called What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life? Now, this is a song that has been covered by many, many, many vocalists with a lot of wonderful versions. I mean, this is the A-team. We're talking the Sinatras and the Shirley Basseys and the Mel Tormes and the Sarah Vaughans and Dusty Springfield. It's real good company. So, Ms. Sutton, you have chosen to add your take to it, and the challenge is, what do you do with a song that is well-known, that is sort of in people's heads, and how do you add your mite to it? What is it that you look for to make an original statement?
Well, with some songs, I feel a lot of responsibility to make an original statement because there's a single iconic version that everyone's heard. Like, for example, It Might Be You, which we'll talk about.
The first record of it was Strife Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
But
I mean, it's been done by Acker, Bilk, and Jesse Norman.
Ranges. But for me, I think in singing that one, it was really more... there's not one singular version that everybody knows. Everybody knows the song, but everybody doesn't look at one particular version. So for me, I just really love the song, and Christian Jacob also really loves that song. And
great
so both of us wanted to do just do honor to a song that both of us love in a fairly straightforward way, because there really doesn't need to be anything added to it. The melody is so ornate in and of itself. Mm. The lyric is fairly complex as well. And just to state that, with some songs, just state the song and try to get out of the way of how beautiful the song is. And that's what I wanted to do.
How do you, because it is recorded with just Christian, I shouldn't say just, with Christian Jacob on piano. But how do you break the news to Ray Brinker and to Trey and to Kevin that they don't get to play in that sandbox?
I can actually tell you that sometimes that is a problem, because they do always want to, and it's kind of interesting when we make those choices. I remember there was something we did on an album years ago that we started to do with the whole band, and we ended up deciding that it worked better. When I say we, I say Christian and I decided that it worked better with just the two of us. And I don't think the other two guys have ever entirely forgiven us.
What song was that?
I've got to think of what it was. It was a song, is it Bill Evans or is it, It'll Come to Me. But it was a song that had a very complicated, you know what it was? It was a song called Reflections. That was written by Ellington. Ooh, and it has
who wrote the lyric?
I don't remember who wrote the lyric. See, that was before I was as close to you as I am. Now I would know, but then I didn't know. But somebody wrote the lyric, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's a long, long ago, I gave my heart away. Wanting love so, and in naivete, I dreamed and dreamed. It just became difficult to do it. The band is so sensitive that we could do it with drums and bass coming in and out. But it's such a challenging melody that Christian and I started to do it as a duo, just so that if there was any, you know, there were less parts that had to be right together. Than four.
When you add vocalese to a song, when you're not singing the lyrics, you're singing either counterpoint melody or the melody, do you look at that as part of the arrangement or as part of the vocal?
Well, the vocal's part of the arrangement. I mean, I think the way that I sing and the way that I think about stuff, I want to be inserted into that arrangement. I want to be linked to it and wedded to it in a really solid way. I mean, I think that's one of the things about having such a wonderful band as I have and working together as long as we have. I think that is really what jazz singing really is. You know, Broadway singers and pop singers and lots of other kinds of singers, it's like, here I'm singing, and you'll create an arrangement for me to sing over, you know? And that's kind of the mentality. And there's my arrangement, and I'll sing with it, and it'll be there, and hopefully it'll be nice. I want to be integral to that arrangement. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to be singing it in my head, even if I'm not singing in that moment. So whatever I do, hopefully, is wedded and sunken into that arrangement.
I've always listened to the Tierney Sutton Band as depending on whether you have two basses with you on any given day.
Yeah.
But let's take it in its trio format, it's really almost always a quintet, because your vocals, when you have the words, are one thing, but when you add the vocalese, it almost becomes a flute. It's almost like there's a flautist.
That's nice. I realized when I started doing some things with Hubert Laws and doing some things with him on alto flute that always my goal had been to make that sound that he's able to make, you know? And so, but a lot of times I just want to dip my toe in the water before I may even sing a lyric. I want to feel the temperature. I want to tune myself to what's going on over there, even if it's sotto voce, even if it's inaudible to anybody else, and then start swimming with them. And it doesn't matter that We often have to tell sound people that I don't want my vocal to be so far out that I don't get sunken into the band sometimes. Sometimes I'm going to make that choice, and that's okay.
Alan, in the song, there it opens with this wonderful quartet of words, north and south and east and west of your life. And then later on, you come back to summer, winter, spring, and fall of my life in the lyric. And is that one of those, is that a craft piece where when you had the first quartet, you wanted to come back to it, or did you?
But that's in the melody. The melody, which I have to tell you, Michelle, you know, we said to Michelle, who had written about five or six songs for that spot in the movie, we said, they're all beautiful, but they're not quite right. What happens if the first line of the song is, what are you doing the rest of your life? Knowing that we were going to use that the second time. He said, oh, I like that. And whatever, however long it takes to play that song, that's how long it took him to write the melody. His fingers never left the piano. Wow. And we said, he said something like that. We said exactly that, like that. Play it again. He said, I don't know what I played. And luckily, we had the tape machine go, because he plays and writes all the time. But those, the rhymes are in the music. You just have to find them. They're there. That dictates where those rhymes are.
Yeah, because it's a beautiful structure to have to open in the second line of the song with those four linked thoughts, the geography of east and west and north and south of you, and then to go back to the four seasons later on towards the end of the song gives it an amazing balance.
Yeah, well, also the second eight is the nickels and the dimes.
Yes, right.
But that's dictated by the melody.
Now, this song was sung in the film by Michael Dees. And in the picture, which is called The Happy Ending, and get your minds out of the gutters, folks. But in the picture was an actor by the name of Bobby Darin.
Yeah.
And did it ever come up from anybody to have Bobby Darin sing the song?
No. And Richard Brooks, who wrote it and directed it, a very strong director who knew exactly what he wanted, exactly. And I'll never forget, we called him over, we said, we think we have it, would you come over? And he came over to the house and we sang it to him, and he was smoking a pipe. I'll never forget it. And he said, yeah. And that was all.
Betty said,
Sometimes that's all you have to hear is yeah.
Well, didn't you say that you sent Michelle out to see a double feature?
We said, leave us alone. We love this melody. Find something to do.
Yeah. We are talking with the great Alan Bergman, who together with Marilyn Bergman, of course, wrote all these magnificent songs that appear in Act One of Screenplay, the new musical collection celebrating film music by the Tierney Sutton Band. Tierney Sutton is with us as well. I want to move to 1982's film called Best Friends, which is a very, very a charming picture with Goldie Hawn. And basically, when Goldie Hawn said she was in, Norman Jewison said he was in, and you had worked with Norman before.
Yeah.
And you wrote a song that is another staple. How do you keep the music playing? A beautiful song. It's a question song. It's like the previous one was, too. Yeah, there's punctuation in these songs.
Yeah, they write with punctuation.
You see very few commas in songs. Softly, comma, as I leave you. But these are question songs. And does it answer the question?
Well, I hope, at the end of the song... it says the music may never end if you play it.
We can be the best of lovers,
yet
be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, with any luck.
Then I suppose the music never ends. And, this song was written in context. These two people who were writers together, collaborators, and... one of them wanted to get married. The other said, no, if we get married, it'll be the end of the romance. But they get married. And then they go, they were writers out here, they go east to meet the in-laws. And after 2 weeks, the marriage is over. And there's a scene where he wanted this song, which is on a people mover, after they got off the plane. And they were kind of separate, and they weren't talking to each other. And we had to find some way to say what happened, but not. So it's, how do you keep the music playing? How do you keep the romance alive? It's what that song is about.
Now the version that the Tierney Sutton Band has just recorded starts with your vocal, and then Christian Jacobs' piano comes in and is a bridge to Alan Bergman's response with another question, a follow-up question, if you will. Conversation between the two of you, again, you have performed this song many times before, but you've usually done it solo, Alan, when I've heard you sing it. And I'm always curious when a songwriter, when a lyricist sings his or her own lyrics, does Alan Bergman, the vocalist, learn something about Alan and Marilyn Bergman, the lyricist, when you're singing their words?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Mm. You have, you know, the real intent, what was going on in your minds when you were writing it and so forth. But that song, The Bridge, was written as a duet. I mean, Michelle wrote that, you know.
He really wrote that.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
And, you know, we had just finished... Just a side story. We had just finished that song, and Quincy Jones came over to have dinner with us. And Michelle was living with us, and he saw that title, the manuscript. We had just finished it that afternoon. He said, let me hear that. And we sang him, and he didn't get... Through 8 bars, he took the manuscript off. He said, that's mine. And, we were lucky enough to have him produce the record with James Ingram. Sorry to say, he just died. And Patty Austin, you know, he produced that record for the movie.
Now, this song, this morning before I came over here, I fell into a YouTube rabbit hole, and
saw a lot of big hair, didn't you?
Not only watched the original version of it, but I also watched Tony Bennett singing it someplace recently. And Tony makes a meal out of the ending. He takes this huge ending on this, which, and I love Tony, but I always thought when he was younger, I thought that it was ostentatious. And then now that he's gotten older, it makes me cry because it's so impressive and so incredible that, you know, he's able to do that. But you do exactly the opposite. I wanted to ask you about this line in the song, because it has a line, keep the song from fading too fast. And that's kind of what you do on the ending of this. You let it fade, but not too fast.
Well, Trey Henry did the arrangement for this, and his idea was that it would be like the sound of a music box, that little figure at the beginning. Doo-dee-doo-dee-doo, doo-dee-doo. And maybe we'll, you know, intersperse this podcast with little bits of the music or entire tracks. Who knows? But... that little music box sound is supposed to represent the fragility of relationships, that it's fragile, and that we're all kind of walking on eggshells, wondering, what can we do? That's really how we feel. We feel very tender about this. This isn't something to be screamed about. And listening to Alan sing their work for so many years, that's an empowerment I feel I got from watching him and interpreting his readings.
You're too kind.
Because, well, now I'm not too kind. and that's the way I felt. I think that I think that, for example, the drama of the melody of something like What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life? Or How Do You Keep the Music Playing? There's enough drama in the melody and in the music that if you can read it with a little more introspection, I think it's more powerful.
As the author of these words and the creator of the material, and I'm not referring specifically to Tony in this case, Tony Bennett in this case, but when you hear a version, somebody take your material and
he's too nice to say
violated.
Anything about it. You know,
no, but I'll tell you, there was a lot of love connected with that song because Quincy, of course, you know, we go back to so many years with him. And Frank Sinatra went to see a preview, a screening of that movie, Best Friends. And he came out of the movie and he called Tony Bennett. He said, "I don't have a date coming up, but I just heard," and it was very complimentary about
the best
song.
Yeah.
And so they said, "You have to go in and record it." And Tony Bennett went the next week, he went in and recorded. And that's over 30 years ago. He closes every show with it
right. Since
then. So, you know, there's a lot.
And I think I heard Quincy say at the tribute they did to you a couple years ago that it was his favorite song.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, I mean, that's big stuff.
Well, it's what Bennett's doing with it is, like I said, it made me cry today. It was so emotional to watch this amazing talent with this amazing piece of material and do his thing. But it always seems to me, anyway, that the theatricality of the big ending is counterpoint to the way the song, the intent,
you know,
of the...
Well, he's trying to make it his own.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to do. But, you know, I'm always reminded of one evening, Alan was singing with the Pasadena Pops. Michael Feinstein was conducting. And there were about three other singers on the bill. And I don't remember who they were. They were all very good singers, and they were all singers with big, belty voices. And you're singing in front of a props orchestra, and it's an open-air thing, you know, all I don't know, 1,000 people or whatever it is on chaise lounges and eating their picnic lunches and all the rest of it. And Alan came up in the second half of the show, and he sang Windmills of Your Mind, and got the most enormous standing ovation from that crowd, and was the only singer to get that. It wasn't that they were just in the mood.
Yeah.
And so I've seen this happen so many times with Alan, where he goes to the heart of the material, of course. He wrote it, you know? And he doesn't feel it necessary to make something overly dramatic. He reads it the way it was intended, and with service to what it is.
I can't take all the credit, you know. I only write every other word.
There you go. Yeah, but you were the one that sang it that day.
Yeah.
And so I've seen this enough times, and it's something that I learned in performing years ago. Whenever the band would go places and they'd say, you know, this audience talks, they're loud, we realized the best way to make them quiet was to start with something really soft.
Well, that's what Peggy Lee did.
Yeah.
Peggy Lee controlled the crowd by, you get louder, I'll get quieter.
No, that's exactly right. And so a lot of times, the louder the audience, I'll start with a long a cappella thing. And I will not sing loud. And there's going to be three people in that audience that drove a long way and paid a bunch of money.
Yeah.
And they'll shut everybody up.
This is totally useless to the podcast or to the documentary, but it's just observational. I've emceed a bunch of these, the LA Political Roasts. It's a big fundraiser at the Biltmore, at the Hilton for the American Diabetes Association. And it's the worst crowd in the world. It's 1,000 politicians and lobbyists and their benefactors. And it's their prom, and they do not stop talking. Except... we had a city councilman die right before the show started one year.
God.
So they threw together a quick video tribute, and they started the show. But what was fascinating was as soon as the video came on, the audience shut up. But a living person in front of them, they would talk through. But we are so acclimated now to video images that people would respectfully not talk through a movie, but
that's
for
crazy.
A human being in front of them,
that's
they didn't care.
Well, I'm sure you're such a great singer, they don't talk much.
No, not much through.
It's happened.
Although the bartenders will still make a mixture, turn the blender on.
Sure,
somehow.
Well, you gotta do what you gotta do.
All right, let me reset and we'll move on to the next song. We are talking about the new multi-track film tribute by the Tierney Sutton Band called Screenplay, and with Tierney Sutton and Alan Bergman. In 1982, the Bergmans, together with Dave Grusin, wrote a hit, a big hit song. It was the number one song in the country for a couple of weeks, sung by Stephen Bishop. It was called, of course, It Might Be You, from the film Tootsie. And this is... this was just a great pop tune, just a wonderful pop
well,
tune.
Dave is such a great composer. Mm. You know. Yeah, I can't remember who it was, but they had hired some group, rock or contemporary group, to write the song and sing it in it. Not that song, Ace. And Dave called, was on a Friday, and Dave called and said they can't come up with it.
It was on a Friday.
And just Sydney saying. Called and said, will you do this for us? You know, and luckily Dave had written the melody already. So we spent the weekend, we wrote it the weekend, they recorded the next week with Stephen Bishop, who did a wonderful job.
Does it, I guess I could probably guess the answer to this because you're going to say it's in the music, which is, when you work on a song like this, because they were looking for a rock performer or just a rock band to create that sound, and you were coming out of more of the traditional American songbook tradition, how does that shape your approach to the
Well,
lyric?
The melody was there, and the context was there of, you know, the Dustin Hoffman character was in character. He was dressed as a woman, you know. And before that, he was always looking for some woman to fall in love with, and he couldn't find her, and he couldn't get a job unless he became a woman. And then every time he looked at... Jessica Lange, I think it was. No.
Mm-hmm. Jessica Lange.
Jessica Lange. Everything he said, we thought that this, he would look at her and there would be, well, it might be, you know, it could be, you know, I haven't decided yet. Didn't want to commit. So that's where we got the idea.
So you kind of got to pioneer cross-dressing songs because years later you wrote with Cy Coleman a musical called Like Jazz.
Yeah.
And in Like Jazz, you and Marilyn wrote a song about a transsexual, basically, jazz musician, a real person.
Yeah.
Which song was that?
I can't remember the title off the top of my head. But it was
woman. I thought you were going to where we did Yento because she.
Ah,
oh, there too.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's three versions of it. there's also a heartbeat or a clock tick percussive sound to the arrangement.
And you know what Trey said to me? We were working on this yesterday with no drums, and it works with no drums. That first pulse, do, 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 it's chords. And he said he wants it to sound like a train passing.
Mm-hmm.
A train passing, and it does. Once he said that, I said, whoa, that's deep. Yeah, this is Trey's arrangement, and he sent it to me about a year ago. He sent me a little... an MP3 of, you know, the synth mock-up of this thing and a lead sheet. And I knew right away that he had hit it out of the park. And what he said was, the perspective of this is someone talking to themselves, thinking aloud. Basically, this is supposed to be super intimate and like someone thinking in their head about their own thoughts, trying to uncover what they're really thinking. And the very first pitch that I sing is a half step away from one of the tones in the chord. I think it might be a half step away from the root of the chord. But that's just what he wrote, and it's perfect. So it's like, here's this pulsing train passing by, and I sing time. I've been passing time watching trains go by.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the T word, time, because I wanted to ask Alan about this. In the sweep, but even looking at the sweep of your catalog, there's a lot of references to either time, or the weight of time seems to fall heavily in your songs and what you write about. And I'm curious if, I mean, for instance, if you go back to a song that means a great deal to me because it's my wife and I, it's our song, she sang at our wedding, which was Nice and Easy. So that's a song that always means an awful lot to us personally. But from the swinging sort of youthful Nice and Easy, as you have matured, you and Marilyn and your relationship has deepened, do you think that that shaped your acknowledgement of time in lyrics?
Well, I don't know. But, you know, even Nice and Easy, which was one of the first things we wrote together, that it was written for Sinatra, and that's, you're writing a custom-made suit for somebody. I mean, you know, he's got a distinct personality, and in writing for him, there's the context, you know, which takes it for
almost
me.
Almost like writing for a film, in
yeah.
a sense.
It's just a three-minute movie.
Mm.
Huh? It's a three-minute movie, that's all, when it's a standalone song. Yeah. And always been... And this is, I'm just totally self-indulgent, even more than what the rest of this has been. But that song and that album of Sinatra's, which is a masterpiece, the whole album is a masterpiece, but Nice and Easy is an outlier because there's nothing nice and easy about the rest of the album. There's songs of loss and regret, how deep is the ocean, and you know.
Yeah, but he was doing an album of slightly swinging love songs. Mm-hmm. And that's what the description was from his manager in right. those days. And so that's how we wrote. And it's funny. Just recently, there's a man who, Charles Pignola, his name is, who handles Sinatra's.
Yeah, I know Charlie.
Yeah. Well, he just sent me three versions of Frank doing it that night in 1960. Three different versions of Nice and Easy. You know, until he got to the one he liked. And it's interesting because you can tell Frank is finding ways to make what he wanted out of it. And
did he have the finger snaps in all three?
No. But he read the lyric differently.
What were some of the differences that you remember?
Well, melodically, he would take liberties, and I mean, they weren't terrible, but they weren't what Lou wrote. And but he went back. They finally got it right. He and we were in the, you know, it was at Capitol, and you know, in Hollywood, and he. He let us, we were very young, he let us in the control room. Mm. And he said, well, how about it, kids? And he called us the kids forever. You know, we had we had dinner with him. We were in our 70s. And he said, oh, the kids.
I just heard the great comedy screenwriters, Lowell Gans and Bobble and Mandel, they got the Writers Guild Laurel Award. And they said, one of the great parts about being partners is that they'll always call you the boys, no matter how old you are. So that's I guess that's what, man. And of course, Sinatra actually presented you and Marilyn and Michelle with your Academy Award when you won your first Academy Award.
Oh, that's cool.
Unfortunately, Michelle wasn't there.
Right.
But he said, as he was leaving, on a stage that night. He said, "Nice going, kids." You know.
Yeah. But that story actually explains a lot of what we touched on earlier about when you're writing a standalone song, a song specifically for a vocalist, as opposed to a scene in a movie, you still have to approach the character.
Absolutely. Especially one that personality and character that Frank had. I mean, you know, indelible.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the final song of the Bergman Suite from Screenplay, which is from a film called Mulholland Falls in 1996. This is another song written, the melody is by Dave Grusin. Now, the song does not appear in the film. The melody came from the film.
The theme appears in the film.
And then it was added. This is similar to The Shout of Your Smile. Johnny Mandel's The Shout of Your Smile was a theme to The Sandpiper, and the lyric was added later when people heard the melody and said, boy, that would make a good song if there were words to it.
Yeah, well, this melody of Dave's, this is many years later. We wrote a lyric to her because he asked us that we loved the lyric, we loved the melody. So,
now, Ms. Sutton, this is the opposite of some of the other Bergman songs, which have been recorded by many people.
Yeah, this
you get to introduce this lyric to the world, and that's got to be quite exciting.
How lucky can we be?
Well, how lucky can I be?
No.
Because honestly, song for song, this is the one that punches me right in the gut. It's really hard to say this because Alan and Marilyn have written so many great songs, but this is right up there with Where Do You Start and, you know, these songs that when people hear them for the first time, they go, you know, because the melody is so beautiful, the harmony is beautiful, and the words just are great. And so for me, I'm so happy and honored to be able to basically do the first released recording of this song, and there's no arrangement because I don't want there to be an arrangement. I just wanted to say, check this out. How beautiful is this, everybody? I've been doing demos of songs that Alan and Marilyn wrote for 10 years or more, where they would just call me and say, hey, you know, we have this song we wrote with John Williams and we don't have any recording of it. Would you mind just coming and doing a little recording of it? So I've been doing that for them for a long, long time, and it's my favorite gig in the world to do. It's the most fun thing. And so many beautiful songs came through that process. And in this case, Alan did the demo of this. And I sat there, and we were at Mitch's, and he was singing this, and I said, you know, Alan, I really, really love this song. How come I don't get to do this one? And he did a beautiful demo of it, but I was really annoyed because I wanted to sing this one, and I usually got to sing them, and I was frustrated.
I don't know why I did it.
I don't know why you did it either, but I had enough of that. And so I said, I'm going to put it on this record because it is from a film. And I just love it. I think
it's a wonderful melody.
Oh.
Well, and getting to take the first crack at it and the way that you chose to put it so simply in the collection allows the song to just live as in its most basic form, which is pretty damn good form for it to be in. And then undoubtedly somebody else will add strings or do whatever they do to it. But for the first reading of it, we get to hear it in its in the way I assume you heard it when you were working on it.
Absolutely.
I want to talk, if we can, for a minute about exactly what you brought up, the collaboration that you and Marilyn have had with Tierney over many years. I know that you're enormously devoted to Johnny Mercer, and I'm a Mercer junkie.
Well, he was my mentor. I wouldn't be here without him.
Yeah. He's one of my I think he's America's greatest poet, but that's just me. But I always, in reading his bios, Richard Whiting's daughter Margaret Whiting, Mercer used to give a lot of the songs when they were fresh off the pad to hear a first reading from Margaret Whiting. She got to sing those songs the first time. And that's an experience that you've had in this room many times, Tierney.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's an indescribable pleasure. It's one of those things that makes you want to continue doing this crazy thing, you know, because that's what it's about. You know, a singer like me that isn't a composer, finding these things, it's like getting food. You know, it's like finding a new cuisine that you haven't had before. It's really the best.
And what are you listening for, Alan, when you're listening to Tierney sing a brand new, a new composition, and you're hearing it really, you know, it's almost like when actors direct themselves.
And I always ask him, when I sing a new thing, I always say, listen, tell me what you think about the phrasing, and he's great about that. He knows just what to say. He'll say, you know, what if you took this part a little faster and make sure that you connect that to that, and, you know, he'll give me gentle guidance about things that I might not have thought about.
But are you listening for... You know, are you listening for the vocal performance, or are you listening to hear how the lyric lies with the melody?
Well, both, but, you know, great singers like Tierney tell a story, and it's there, the reading, and sometimes could be a little this. Mostly, we're listening to whether it's good enough, whether it's finished, you know? If people ask, when do you know your song is finished? And the only answer we have is when they take it away.
Yeah.
Because you keep rewriting, you keep making it better. There's another street to go down.
You know, they did this to Arthur Miller when they did one of the last revivals of Death of a Salesman in New York when Arthur Miller was still with us, and he started rewriting the play during rehearsals.
Wow.
And they had to take, they said, you can't rewrite, the audience's lips are moving to the dialogue, and he says, yeah, but I in act two, you know, he saw it differently because he was looking at it from 50 years out.
20 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a whole, you get a whole other perspective.
Yeah.
You know, Nice and Easy, for instance, if we hadn't written that for Frank, we would never have, in the beginning of the second eight, say, hey, baby, what's it? But hey, baby was him.
Right,
but
yeah.
But we wouldn't say that anymore.
Yeah. I heard a song coming down here, Sinatra singing, and I think it's Joe Raposo, but I'm not sure. It's called I Love You, and this song is... I love you so. He never told her. There's one thing she didn't know, that I love her because I never told her so, is the ending of it. And there's the lyric in it is, you're Mozart, I'm Basie, you're, you know, it's two total opposites. And there's even a line in there, opposites attract. But there's a song that's so specific. I'm Dodgers, you're Polo. I mean, it's so specific.
Yeah, I think the title of that song is I Never Told You.
It's a beautiful song. But it's so specific to him that it's almost not transposable to another person, you know. But the process of a collaboration, I mentioned this now the second reference to Lowell Gantz. I worked on a TV series with Lowell Gantz many years ago. And I'm going to try to link this back to the collaboration between hearing your song sung for the first couple of times and whether you rework it. We were writing a scene on a sitcom. And during the rehearsal, the dialogue coach was reading this small part. It was a little like West Tech private security guy. And he read it like he was a Nazi, you know, clipped, harsh.
Wow.
And when we went up to the rewrites, Lowell said, look, we could wait till the actor comes in tomorrow, but what did we put on the paper that made him think we wanted that? He made a choice based on what we wrote. Why did he get that signal? Because he's an experienced dialogue coach. And when we looked at it, it was all short sentences, three-word sentences, period. One word, period. Mm. So he naturally thought we wanted this guy to be Mm. You know, and I thought, well, it was a brilliant self-critique to look at your work that way and not blame the, you know, the dialogue coach. Mm. But I'm wondering, when you hear a Tierney Sutton sing your song and you're hearing it for the first time, not in your voice, do you listen for the choices she makes, and does that shape any rewrites you may do?
Sometimes, but the before it gets to her, you know, songs that I've written, they're rewritten over and over, and we kind of hone it as far as we can go, and then when we hear it sung, there are certain things that could be could sit on those notes a little better.
Mm.
And so we kind of try to go back and fix that, you know.
And over these years, I've become just a tiny bit presumptuous, so that here and there, I might say, could we say may instead of might here? Because it might sing better, as long as it wasn't repeated. And little tiny things like that. And often, he'll say, oh, that's not bad, that's fine. Or he'll say, no, we can't do that because of this. Something that I didn't notice because he's him and I'm me. But so there's little ways sometimes that I'll...
Do you get the songs, if you're gonna sing a song for Alan and Marilyn for the first time, do they send it to you or do they spring it on you?
No, well, they spring it on me, but they usually give me 24 hours.
Okay.
So what usually happens is he'll come, and usually I have more than 24 hours, but often with a lot of these things, like Bobby Deerfield and all these things, you would send me these god-awful lead sheets. I got to tell you, some of these things were 20 years old and you could barely see them, and they're Xerox copies of God only knows what in D flat major. And I would sit there, and this is before music software, so I would sit down at the piano, I'd figure out what the key was, and usually the range of these things is like really big, and so I'd have to find the lowest note I could sing normally at the beginning and figure out how high it goes. Then I would hand transpose a chart for myself in the new key so that I could play through it and learn the melody. But that would help me learn the melody and how it would go. And then the next day, I'd show up at Mitch's as if, well, I just sight-read this, but I'd actually spent about 3 hours, you know, going through it carefully, finding the right key, handwriting the chart, making sure I didn't make any transposition mistakes, and trying to mostly memorize a lot of it so that I could read it with some kind of confidence, you know. And a lot of times I'll say to him, oh, you know, this might be fine. I just don't have it in my bones well enough to be reading it well enough. So, because a lot of things, I mean, think of what you're doing the rest of your life. You know, you had Barbara, okay? And I've heard those recordings of Barbara singing it for the first time when she was learning it with Michelle LeGrand. She's amazing. So she's singing like a bird. She's getting all those melodies. And then he's harmonizing with her on the bridge and she's cracking up. And she's kind of losing it. And she's like, yeah, you know, you write this crazy melody and then you sing this crazy thing. And it's adorable. But I think about that because when you learn something because you hear a singer like Barbara Streisand sing it, it puts that melody right in your head. You're like, that's what it is. And when you have to do it and no one has ever done it before, you have to present it as if you've heard it for your whole life. You have to really
inhabit
it. And these are challenging melodies. Dave Grusin and Michelle LeGrand and these guys, they don't write jingle bells. I mean, they're writing really complicated, rangy, strange things.
Well, this is the art
things.
Of singing, because, you know, every production of Hamlet has the same dialogue, so why is Olivier's Hamlet different than Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet? It's because of what they're bringing to their life experience that they bring to it, and their own level of craft, and then that magic. Because craft only takes you so far, then there has to be magic. There's a lot of magic on these songs, ladies and gentlemen. 19 tracks. It's called Screenplay. Act one is the Bergman Suite, and I have to say, as a person who literally can't whistle for a cab, when I whistle for the dog goes further away from the house. That's how little musical ability I have. I would do this for double the pay I'm getting to spend this much time with Alan Bergman and Tierney Sutton. T TierneySutton.com. The project's called Screenplay. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.